Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Waite, and my guest tonight is the poet Jan Beatty. Jan Beatty's new book, Red Sugar, has just been released by the University of Pittsburgh Press. Other books include Bone Shaker and Mad River, both from the University of Pittsburgh Press. Mad River was the winner of the 1994 Agnes Lynch Starrett Prize. Ravenous, her limited edition chapbook, won the 1995 State Street Prize. Beatty's poetry has appeared in Quarterly West, Gulf Coast, Indiana Review, and Court Green, and in anthologies published by Oxford University Press, University of Illinois Press, and the University of Iowa Press. Her awards include the $15,000 Creative Achievement Award in Literature from the Heinz Foundation and Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, the Pablo Neruda Prize for Poetry, and two fellowships from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. Beatty directs the creative writing program at Carlow University, where she runs the Mad Women in the Attic writing workshops and teaches in the MFA program. We're taping the show in celebration of the release of her new book and also a book release party that's sponsored by WYEP that'll be on Friday, April 18th. Hi, Jan. Welcome to Prosody.
Hey, Ellen. How you doing?
I'm fine. Have you ever heard of Prosody?
I think I have. It sounds familiar, yeah.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit from Red Sugar?
Sure. I'm going to read, everything I read is going to be from Red Sugar tonight. This is a poem called Procession. Little Wren, your body is breaking down into air. I find you under my desk, how long dead. What do the hollowed black cones of your eyes and your tiny claws have to tell me about home? Your small patch of city yard, droop of telephone wire on your daily flight, the wind draft over the Allegheny. I pray to the four directions, then put your body in the trash, cover you with typewriter ribbons and calendar days and press down. 10 minutes later, I dig you out, carry you outside in the styrofoam box, and we walk the streets of Etna while big-haired women watch from their porches. Across Butler Street, the workers of the Tippins machinery plant break open their lunch buckets on the stone wall. At the churchyard, I dig behind the hydrangea with my father's tack hammer and cast iron awl. Everything goes on without us. If I could see the cities inside you, if I could find my own ocean of light. In the hole, paper with a stamp of an orange sun on it and the word finished. A piece of carnelian and last words. I'm sorry. I know you're alone in this room of poems. I tried to hide your death. Rest in peace. May 29th, Calvert United Presbyterian Church. This next one is really about the pressure to not speak, which comes from many places. And the pressure when you do speak to make it nice. This is called Make It Beautiful. When you tell it, don't say it straight. Just say, one dreamy moonlit night, she looks up and the flowers in the curtains are suddenly burning. Then say something like, eyes, eyes, scream the small O. Because no one will believe it. Everyone is sick of it. And don't ever say, 7 years old, tiny pearl, bramble of hair, thick man, slimy girl, spoiled food, large hands, no door, ever. This is the title poem of the book, Red Sugar, and it begins with an epigraph by the nature writer Gretel Ehrlich, which people might be surprised that I like nature writers, and I actually love nature writers anyway. But these are the words of Gretel Ehrlich. You walk inside yourself on roads and ropes of blood vessels and tendons. You walk inside yourself and eat weather. Red sugar. When I was young, I was a comet with an unending shimmering tail, and I flew over the brokenness below that was my life. I didn't know until I was 12 that we carry other bodies inside us, not babies, but bodies of blood that speak to us in plutonic languages of pith and serum. When I was 6, there was a man in the woods, naked. I didn't know him, but I knew he was a wrong kind of man, so I ran. With my inside body, I see his skinny white bones and curled mouth. He looks like sickness, and it's the body inside me that's running, my red sugar body that shows me the brutal road to love, the one good man, the one song I can keep as mine. I heard it once when I was waitressing. Something made me turn my head, made me swivel to look at a woman across the room. Wasn't even my station, but the red sugar said, "Go." When I saw her up close, I knew she was blood. I can't explain this. I only met my mother once. I said, "Do you know a woman named Dorothy?" Her face was pale. She said no, in that hard way. Maybe her red sugar told her to run, but before she left, she grabbed my arm, said, "I did have a sister named Dorothy, but she died." 2 inches away from her dyed blonde hair, I said, "Okay." But both our inside bodies knew she was lying. Some people call it eating weather, the way you swallow what you know but keep it. Later it rises like a storm from another world. Reptilian and hungry, it's the thickness that drives us and stains us, the not asking, just coming. The uncut garnet and the lava flow, it's barbarism, bloodletting, the most liquid part of us, spilling, spreading, the granular red sea of sap and gore, sinking, moving forward at the same time, slippery, red containing blue, it's the sweet deep inside of the body.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Jan Beatty. Jan, I wanted to talk about Red Sugar. The title poem is kind of a gateway to the book. One, kind of some of the ideas that are in that poem that, you know, you're kind of working with throughout the book. Maybe if you could just talk about it, its genesis a little bit.
Well, actually, that poem, Red Sugar, I wrote out in Wyoming. I was at this residency called Gentel. And it happened to be the time when Mars, the planet Mars, was closest to the Earth, you know, and the red planet. And I swear to God, everything, I was there with a lot of, there were a lot of women at the residency at that time. And everybody started wearing red. It was this crazy thing. And red started just popping up everywhere in our writing. And there was a painter who started painting these huge red flowers. It was crazy. Anyway, so that's when Red Sugar was sort of born. I think it had to do with that. But you know, I think the main thing is that, you know, the woman in that poem is talking about her beginnings, and Red Sugar is really blood. And the whole book is really about, you know, blood as code, as the ultimate storyteller. And this woman who's running through the book is recorder of dreams and culture. And so she's looking for things. And, you know, there's definitely an autobiographical connection there in the sense that I was, you know, born in Rosalia Foundling Home in Pittsburgh, home for unwed mothers, they used to call them. And you know, I didn't know my beginnings for a long time and still don't know that much. So I wanted to talk about, you know, somehow, you know, blood as determiner and what drives us that we don't know is driving us. And so all that was sort of swirling around with the planet Mars.
And all that red.
Yeah, that's
out what happened. In Wyoming. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the you know, the collection kind of as the step after Bone Shaker as well. I mean, I can hear and I can see on the page the kind of connection that happens between the two books. There's definitely it seems to me like a progression in observation. There's some progression in language. But where I would describe Bone Shaker maybe is kind of slicing into subjects and maybe letting us kind of peel back the skin a bit and look at the muscle. This book to me, it, you know, the incision is deeper. The probing is deeper, and the wounds are the spaces that are opened up are actually kind of peeled back more. So I was just wondering if you could kind of talk about like how this book with the language or the observation kind of made its next step.
Well, yeah, I think you're right about that. I see it as sort of a progression from my first book, Mad River, where there was a woman walking around that book who was a waitress and a wanderer and telling these short narratives about what she saw. So it was sort of the body walking around. And then in Bone Shaker, as you said, it was, you know, the body starting to break apart. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of slashes in Bone Shaker. And to me, that was, you know, speech being interrupted and the body starting to bust loose and things falling apart and sort of shaking your bones to a point of not knowing who you were anymore. And so with Red Sugar, I was attempting, you know, I don't know if I was able to do it, but I was trying to get inside the body and talk about the body from the inside out, which is kind of impossible. But I wanted to try that and say that's sort of the Red Sugar blood thing, to speak in terms of blood, and because I'm obsessed with that idea. But I wasn't sure how to do that. But in terms of craft, again, I have a lot of slashes, but I was trying to be much more organic and less explaining in the book. So
yeah, there's a real sense in the language, I think, that it's the blood, but it's also the image of blood. But there's also the language that's in this book, to me, is negotiating us both inside and outside surfaces of the body.
Right. Yeah, I don't want people to get the idea that this is a bloody, terrible book, but it's, you know.
No, it's anything but that.
But there's a lot, you know, there's humor, and there's a lot of, there's still the stories running through. There's still this waitress, and there's still the steel mills. Everything's still there.
Yeah. Other landscapes as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How about you read some more?
Sure. This is a poem for the poet Judith Vollmer, and she's in this poem. I have her permission to do this. And no one is saying that this is a true poem, of course, but this is called The Phenomenology of Sex. I tell my friend Jude about the phenomenologist I'm dating. We were doing poppers in Texas in his living room and on our knees having sex, and I turned around to look just before the big O and saw him chewing the wooden arm of the easy chair. And then you broke up with him? No, I didn't get the message. I tell her how he talks phenomenology to me, how consciousness is everything, how important it is to suspend assertions of existence independent of consciousness, which I take to mean he's afraid of living. Jude says the bottom line is he's chewing on the chair. What are you going to do? I tell her how, in Pittsburgh, he tried to teach me how to drive my own car. How I said to him, if this car crashed in a forest, you couldn't hear it, but I would. So that was it? Yeah, that was it. This is called The Long White. I think it was a Lincoln, the man's hand coming from the open door. Come here, in front of my house. I was 9. I stood still. I want to talk to you. I started walking towards school, the long white beside me, and I wasn't really scared. Just in another separate place of my own. I wasn't wishing for anything, just watching my feet walking fast, the hand reaching out. Could they see a fresh girl who didn't know her real parents? The wide open face with no protection, the paleness that says, I'm lonely. I'm wandering, and could be scooped up in a minute if you insist. I just want to talk to you. And after a while, I just jumped in. I thought of this 20 years later when the cab pulled up and there was fog and 3 ravens sitting on the wooden totem of the ashes of dead Inuit. I stepped into the long white outside the closed train station. 5 a.m., Prince Rupert, British Columbia. The cab pulled up. The same man's hand threw open the passenger door. The same question, need a ride? Yes, yes, I climbed in. But this time I told about it. Blurted my story to this stranger, a father who I never knew where he was from. Someone said a hockey player from Canada. And he said, yes, yes. And I told him, I always wondered about my father. And his head swung around and he insisted, you need to look for him. You need to do this. I didn't know I had been getting in cars with men all my life looking for him, a passenger in the long white until then. This is a love poem coming up for my husband, Don. Dreaming Door. You bought donuts in the morning of our first days, and we watched the great rivers through my south side windows, everything swelling. We ate in the turquoise kitchen and opened the dreaming door. Our Pittsburgh rolling by on the coal barges, the P and LE carting steel to the still rising cities of the West. A couple speedboats running the dirty summer Monongahela. You on your way to work. I said, no one's ever been this nice to me. As I walked you the 52 steps down from my third floor apartment, you tilted your head, looking at me in a way I'd never seen, like I was the most sublime person, your blue eyes seeming truly puzzled. I haven't even started to love you yet. And at the door, the world barreling through, this time with gifts, fierce fires, and planets of luck.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Jan Beatty. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the language in this book. You said earlier how you were trying to write from a more organic place. And there's real momentum to the language in this book. In fact, at times I felt it was almost predatory in mm-hmm. a way. It had that kind of force behind it. So then I started thinking about how you give shape or how you frame something that has that kind of momentum going for it without trying to make it too constructed. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering how kind of work you were doing just to keep it both forceful and semi-contained.
Well, what do you mean predatory?
Predatory in the sense that there's, you know, there are times with the way it was moving, it wasn't stream of consciousness, but it had force, mm-hmm. and it felt that it was both moving on the page and coming at me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what I wanted.
Well, it worked.
Okay, good. Yeah, you know, my last book came out in 2002, so it's been 6 years. So it took a while and a whole lot of revising. And, you know, the poems tended to be longer, and then I would cut back and cut back and then, you know, try to work with the line to get that sense of movement and, you know, again, using slashes to mm-hmm. try to, you know, direct the flow of the line or the pace at which things are being read. And so, you know, it just, you know, I'm relentless. And, you know, people have said to me, you know, recently, old friends have said, you know, I used to think you were easygoing. And I'd be like, nah.
I wouldn't have said that.
No,
to you.
Well, you know me better and more recently. But yeah, I am really obsessed and relentless with this stuff. And I just go back and back and just try to, you know, if I put this word here, if I move this word there, and every poet knows that, and you know that
sure.
as a fiction writer, that every word is important. But I just kept fighting with it. You know, it was coming after me too. I was going after it, you know.
Well, because what I would say, again, with like the force of the language that seemed different to me in this book, in Boneshaker, there were more stories based on events.
Right.
Where in this book, there seems, you know, we're chasing something. Mm-hmm. But, and that's what I mean by predatory too. We're not always sure what it is, but mm-hmm. we know it's out there.
Right.
And sometimes it's in terms of a deeper truth. Sometimes it's in terms of a contradiction. So, you know, they aren't framed as much. They're still stories. You're still following a line of thought, but it's not so much about people.
Right. I mean, there are people in the book, but it's not as, I think, plot-driven or character-driven and story-driven even. I think about the book as sort of a tug of war between the brutal and the romantic, and in that classic American way that, you know, I mean, I believe we all have both impulses inside us and everything in between, and yet culturally we're not supposed to talk about the brutal, and we're taught to romanticize, and especially as women and women writers, and that really irritates me. And so I want to have both things and everything in between rolling around the book. And as, you know, as part of this speaker in the book, sort of owning her desires, you know, just to want things and then her disappointments, but also, you know, the brutality in the world and in her. And, you know, she may have some ideas that aren't too sweet sometimes, and I want to include that.
Yeah, this isn't a speaker who is always looking out at what's going on with other people's issues. There's that's another way the book is kind of in and out of bodies. It's also the kind of community body, the place where you live, but then also how you're a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you think that. That's what I was trying to do.
You want to read some more?
Sure. Sure. This one, I'll read sort of one of each of those kinds. This first one, I mean, it does have a story attached. It's called Stray, and it has to do with that thing you might see on the news sometimes where the perp walk, where someone is in handcuffs and is being led to the jail, up the ramp to the jail, and usually it's a man. And then you might have someone being interviewed on the news who says, "Oh, I really like that guy. He was a great guy." And then you hear all these terrible things he's done. And that always made me kind of crazy, and I can't resolve it. But again, that's the romantic and the brutal and everything in between. So this is called Stray. A guy in a John Deere hat tells the reporter he was quiet, a good neighbor. He took good care of his yard. Then we see his body sunken in on itself, hair hanging down, feet lurching inches at a time in shackles. Sometimes I look at people and think, I can feel the blade of your little machinery turning inside you from some generator, cutting you off from yourself. No trace of the older couple down the street, their bodies he sliced to bits. Up the cement ramp to the county jail, he looks down, pieces of skin still under his fingernails, but nothing we can see. I think, look at his undiscovered cities, the buildings rising in him and their fierce armies. You can't tell how he packaged them in 6-inch squares to be sent through the mail, Christmas presents for the family. Now the woman next door, he made good potato salad, brought it to church functions. Standing in her yard, she looks down, imagines his big hands in the dark blades of her grass, sees him cutting the vegetables next to her daughter in the social hall. Newly afraid, she looks out into the camera. This is a good neighborhood. Nothing like this ever happens here. If someone strays from themselves, does it turn the good in them to dust? Here's what I know. We don't want any trouble. What if he was split off from all kindness from the beginning? I think, you are all little Frankensteins, all little broken-down machines. You put your head down, one foot in front of the other, lurching. This next poem is actually, you know, about my father, and who was a steel worker, U.S. Steel, J&L Works Union, 1272, and I really had to work to find that union number because this was, I think, in the 30s, and the records weren't kept, and, you know, obviously not on computers, and I called the U.S. Steelworkers of America. They didn't know, and I couldn't find it, and my editor said, you know, just put a number in. I said, no, that's the union number. No, I'm not going to do that. Can't mess with the union. And my brother-in-law actually, who's a union guy, found it for me, and quickly. So I had to get an insider, you know. But this is called The Punch. My father at 30 knows the bend over and take it, but he also knows the flip switch, the moment of recalcitrance, when the burn turns to fire, when the body's magma rises up, comes out the mouth full-blown, when the fist swings high in its 60-degree orbit to an uppercut. 130 pounds, all frame, he knows the full 90 into a roundhouse slam, then the walking away, not broken, but changed. My father's geometry is one body up against the wall, with trouble on your hands, but less trouble than if you turned your back. And sometimes anger is the only right language. His punches swing clean like a pendulum into his boss's big knob head and barrel chest. Beatty, get over here and redo this. You really screwed this up. and my father knows he did a fine job, that this is the language of breaking a man down until he doesn't fight anymore, because my father is mouthy. He's union, Steelworkers Local 1272. He has opinions about hours and working conditions, the air they're breathing. When his boss calls him out, his head lifts to a glare. He walks slowly over and delivers an uppercut to the jaw with a trajectory that leads from ground to body in a geometry so sweet you can figure distance, velocity, and angle to conjure the exact position of the bodies when the blows are struck, ciphering through mathematical model the reason two grown men, bodies 10 inches apart, round their fists up, and swing a parabola from this cement floor to this corrugated wall, figuring in the percentages, rage infused by union management history, X the cost of one man's life in this rust town, city of steelworkers who built the country, adding two daughters, the price of one man's dignity and a life of work, one roundhouse punch, the backswing casting off blood in a spatter on the wall of the mill, decking the boss in a circle of steelworkers cheering, red on gray, a siren bleating, violation, so that the investigator will find an overlay on the corrugated steel, blood, spatter over spatter.
The poetry of Jan Beatty. And Jan, you have a book release party coming up, yes?
Right. It's this Friday, actually, book party and reading, Friday, April 18th. And it's sponsored by WYEP at the Community Broadcast Center, which is 67 Bedford Square, Southside. Doors open at 7. Free food and drink. but I want to say that the food and drink is by Barry's Public House, and there'll be books for sale. It should be fun.
And good poetry.
Oh, yeah, poetry, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that too. Thanks. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Amy Sutton and Ziggy Edwards, with special thanks this week to Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.